house file over.
I don't know anything about them, so.
All I know is to just bless anybody who
okay,
goes and
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm delighted to be sitting at this lovely table.
I'm glad you weren't.
Mr. Chairman, this is the bill that's presented to the committee by the Pensions Commission, and I would just like to ask for the A1 amendment first of all. This is to put it in the fiscal order that the chairman would like. Then I have some explanatory comments, and then I have some technical amendments. And while that's being passed out, I'll start with my comments and I'll interrupt myself to take the amendment. So I just wanted to say to members that we owe our best efforts to the over 300,000 active public employees and 171,000 retirees, disabilitants, and survivors to ensure that the promises we have made will be kept. Public employment accounts for over 10% of the state's entire workforce. What we do in the public sector is very important. These public servants are our fellow citizens. They are police officers, teachers, firefighters, highway workers, nurses. They take care of us, our parents, and our children. And if there's one point I hope all members understand about pensions, it's this. It's this number, 1.6%. 1.6% is the total amount of state and local spending that goes to fund pensions in Minnesota. Why is this number important? Because the national average spending on pensions is 2.9%. Minnesota spends just over half as much on pensions as the average state. Minnesota ranks in the lowest 10 states for spending on pensions. And this makes us stand out nationally, and because we've managed our pension obligation as well, so well, our state's creditworthiness is enhanced. The A1 amendment, as I mentioned earlier, there is a funding request in the bill, and this would not kick in that funding request until the second year of the next biennium, so 2017. So I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Okay, we have the A1 amendment in front of us. Is there a discussion on that? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries.
Last year, we made major strides in fixing the funding problems for all the police and fire pension plans in the state. And these problems were not really due to anything that the pension directors did to mismanage their funds or State Board of Investment did. It was the result of the downturn in the economy and the Great Recession. But we did have to fix these problems by adding more funding. And so we did that for the police and fire pension plans in the state. And it was a shared pain. We cut benefits, we raised contributions, and we provided state funds to PERA, police and fire, the state patrol, and all the volunteer firefighter plans. We took plans that had severe problems and made dramatic turnarounds. We cut pension liabilities by $500 million. This year's bill is a continuation of our pension reform efforts. Last year, we also began work to address the problem with the St. Paul and Duluth teachers' funds. We provided 2 years of funding and required a comprehensive study on consolidation options. The Pension Commission spent considerable time in the interim studying the options. The Pension Commission determined the best course was to consolidate Duluth into TRA at a cost of $14.1 million a year and to continue aid to St. Paul at $7 million a year. Duluth, frankly, needs to consolidate because of its demographics. In 1999, it had 1,400 active members and 800 retirees. Now the numbers are reversed, with 1,400 retirees and 800 active teachers. Then there were 15,000 students. Now there are only 9,000 students. They lost students to charter schools. They lost students as well when one of the community colleges merged into TERA. So it's a right decision to merge Duluth. The St. Paul system, after doing their comprehensive study, their board decided it was best for the state for them to stay separate because the cost to consolidate was $29 million more a year to do so than to stay separate. So we think the Pension Commission thought that was the best choice. St. Paul pays lower COLAs. St. Paul has low administrative costs, and St. Paul has had the best investment rates of returns of any pension fund in the state. St. Paul has been an excellently run pension system. It was legislative action in the late 70s depriving the plan of needed employer contributions that created a problem for St. Paul. And it was not until the 1990s that we corrected that error. This legislature has provided financial help like this before. In 1980, we provided aid to the 47 local police and fire pension funds around the state to effectuate good pension policy. We aided the Minneapolis Employee Retirement Fund system in 1978. In 1985, we provided TRA, Teachers Retirement Association, with $30 million a year. We did not help the three first-class sister plans then. We have also provided help again for MRF and the Minneapolis teachers when their models failed in the last decade. In this bill, we helped Duluth and St. Paul for a combined $21 million a year beginning in 2017. There have been concerns expressed on the long-term viability of Duluth. However, Duluth and St. Paul have been in existence for over 100 years. Both plans have a strong history of being responsible and well-run. As I mentioned, Duluth has had demographic challenges, and St. Paul has a history of being underfunded but has had excellent investment returns. And in St. Paul's case, a strong argument can be made that the state should have required higher contributions from 1978 to 1966. Had the legislature done so, the St. Paul teachers would have had an additional $250 million in assets above their $1 billion in assets. We've also put stabilizers in this bill to delay COLA increases by requiring plans to reach 2 years of 90% funding rather than 1 year to allow greater COLA increases for TRA and MSRS. These provisions can be seen as reductions to pensions. In summary, to stabilize the funds, we're reducing benefits, the COLAs, we're increasing contributions for both employers and employees in the MSRS and PERA plans, we're providing some state aid in the case of Duluth and St. Paul to resolve their funding issues. We believe this bill will prove to be yet another measure that keeps the pension system solvent and looked at as an asset to the state's credit rating. And we believe the bill will continue to support these pension systems, which affect a total of nearly 450,000 of our fellow Minnesotans. This is yet another reform bill that keeps the promises we've made, and it does so in a financially responsible manner that reflects well on the legislature and our credit rating. That's a summary of the bill. And now, Mr. Chairman, I do have a couple of technical amendments. And let's start with the 38A. We could have 38A passed out.
It is passed out.
Do you have it, or do they
in
have it? Have it? Okay, it's already passed out.
That's correct.
This has been requested by PERA and MSRS, and it's a technical amendment. And Mr. Bergstrom, did you want to explain it?
No, I'm just.
Oh. Or did Ms. Banff want to explain your amendment, or I can have Larry?
I don't think this was requested.
The 38A? Isn't that Larry's? Isn't that their amendment?
Yeah, this is the one that catches up all the technical changes.
What this does, it's the technical changes, all the technical changes that will make it identical to the House. Just technical things that we caught after the bill left the Pension Commission.
Okay. Senator Pappas moves the 38A amendment. Is there discussion on that? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
And then we have the 39A, which, why don't you explain that one, Larry? Mr. Martin will explain.
Mr. Martin.
Members.
39A.
I'm Larry Martin from the staff of the Pension Commission. The 39A amendment has to do with a part of the bill that divides out the interest rate actuarial assumptions from the post-retirement adjustment actuarial assumptions. When the change was made in the Pension Commission, there was some difficulty with the initial language, and so this clarifies the applicable rates that are to be applied during the period when post-retirement increases are reduced, and then the larger post-retirement adjustment rates after the fiscal problems have been largely resolved. The 39A amendment also clarifies when the actuary is estimating for how long the lower rates will be used, it clarifies that that estimate will be based on the actuarial assumptions used for the actuarial valuation. It also specifies that if there are projected contribution stabilizer contribution rate increases, that those will be taken into account in that estimate. And for the 2015 and later valuations, if the projection, the estimate of when the sustainability is reached, the actuary will include an exhibit that lays out that our projection.
There are no questions, Mr. Chairman. I'll move to 39A.
Okay, we have Senator Pappas' motion, 39A amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Aye. Motion carries.
And Mr. Chairman, I think members should have the fiscal note. And with my amendment, the column that says fiscal year 16 is eliminated to be zero, and so fiscal year 17 is the appropriations to Duluth and to St. Paul.
Mm. All right.
And to summarize that's $14 million, 14.3 to Duluth. 14.3 to Duluth and $7 million to St. Paul.
And Senator Pappas, I don't want to revisit old days in this committee, but this is one of the things we talked about with the presentation of the Supplemental Finance Bill relative to the establishment of the Senate budget for 16-17. So do we have questions for Senator Pappas or for Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I think generally speaking, for a solution for some of these plans is to raise retirement age and that type of thing. Has that type of discussion gone on in your committee at all? And is there any consideration of pushing the retirement age or eligibility age out from what it currently is now
Mr. Chairman, Senator Peterson, we actually have not had discussions about raising the retirement age.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, to that point, could you refresh for the committee, what is the retirement age of the different pension funds?
For people after 89,
69. Mr. Martin's refreshing my memory, Mr. Chairman, it's 66. For people who retire after 1989. Came into the plan after 1989.
65 before.
Before that, it was 65. And people can take early retirement, but they take a penalty. They get less money then.
So Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, when you say early retirement, I'm thinking of some teachers that I know in the past, and they used to be the rule of 90 that allowed them to retire at 56, 57, 58. Do they, for example, not take their pension till 65? And if they do, they take a penalty to kind of actuarially work out? Or
I'll actually let Mr. Martin address
okay.
that.
Yes, Mr. Chair. For members who, or for individuals who were first employed before July 1 of 89, their normal retirement age is either age 65 or, if applicable, if they have long enough service, the rule of 90, and the individual would start their benefit after they achieved the age and combination of age and service, the total 90. And it would not be reduced. It does use an altered formula, so it is a somewhat smaller benefit, but it's unreduced for early our retirement. But that's applicable to a very modest number of members left, the individuals who were employed before 89.
Okay. Mr. Martin, Mr. Chair, what about public safety officials? Do they have a younger retirement payout, or do they just qualify by retiring at, in some cases, 50 or 55, I think, is the range of age some can retire, and the Department of Corrections, if I understand correctly, and different law enforcement. Can you give us a little more background on that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The information I gave you about rule of 90, age 65, age 66, applies to our general employees, our non-public safety employees, for the Highway Patrol, for PRA Police and Fire, for the two correctional plans. The age is age 55, not age 65. And they have larger contribution rates. They're also not covered by Social Security in the case of PERA Police and Fire and the State Patrol.
And Mr. Martin, they're able to receive it upon retirement. They don't wait till 65 or 66 either.
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, they do not wait until a later age. Their normal retirement age is 55. They can retire at age 50 with a reduced benefit.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, last question, Mr. Martin. The 65 to 66, when did that discussion go on, and would that discussion, as Senator Peterson asked, be a piece of a fix rather than just putting more money into the system? So two parts of that question. But when did that occur, and what was that reason, and would, you know, how would that fit into any discussions we're having here today?
Senator, Mr. Chairman, Senator, the shift to age 66 occurred in 1989. It was part of the adding of the rule of 90 for pre-89 hires, and the shift to a later retirement age with a somewhat larger benefit accrual rate that occurred during the 89 session. So that's something that's been part of the law for some period of time. Changing the retirement age would, if it induced people to wait till later ages, would provide actuarial savings. It would strengthen the actuarial situation of the pension fund. It is a benefit reduction if it applies to individuals who are currently members, not just new hires, as was done in 89. And the legislature has been generally slow or reluctant to reduce benefits for existing individuals.
Sure. Thank you.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, to follow up on that, I guess that's what I'm trying to get at, why that hasn't been part of the discussion. I mean, I realize there's a fairness issue. You know, in my mind, if somebody was within 10 years of retirement, I don't think you could do it to those folks. But, you know, somebody that was my age, 45 or 46, you know, certainly it's in an effort to try and preserve the plans and make them a little more fiscally sound. It seems like it's a fairly common and reasonable request. And so is that not being considered just mainly because the members don't view that as a solution?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Peterson, feel free to introduce the bill, and we'll be happy to discuss it next year. It just, I don't know why, it just has never come up. No one is on the Pension Commission, or no one from the public has ever brought it up. You're the first.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I guess if there's no other questions, I would move that whatever the Senate file 1803 is amended.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Peterson.
Senator Westrom.
Senator Westrom, I'm
Mr. Chair, I didn't realize. I thought maybe others were going to have a couple questions. So,
no, we're
just to recap the money. You said there's no money in here, but in the middle of the next biennium, Senator Pappas, can you just refresh or rediscuss that amount and what. Why we're putting that in the next middle of the next biennium?
Well, Senator Westrom,
and the chairman, it's the chairman's budget, his target. He could explain it.
Senator Westrom, this revisits. I think I mentioned this in passing a few minutes ago. This revisits where we were with the Senate budget and with the establishment of the 16-17 tails target. And at the time, I mentioned there were two particular problems. You might recall the bill was presented on Thursday. That determination was made the prior Monday. And there were two particular problems relative to the 16-17 budget. We had extensive conversation in the committee relative to the Minskew tails. And you might recall there were amendments on that. I think Senator Miller offered the amendment, if I'm not mistaken. He did so unsuccessfully, as I recall. And it's an issue that we're revisiting in the Supplemental Finance Conference Committee. The second issue relative to concerns with the tails target was this issue. And I think I indicated at the time that the money was being carried in the supplemental finance bill in terms of the appropriation, but we'd have the pension bill at a later date. So it's revisiting where we were, whenever that was, 3 weeks ago or so.
Mr. Chair, just for the committee's a refresher, what's the amount again on that that tail?
You mean in this bill? It's $21 million.
$21 million. Ongoing, right?
Yes. And again, an issue for the Supplemental Finance Conference Committee and the resolution of obviously a target figure for the combination of finance, bonding, tax.
And Mr. Chair, and maybe I think this might be more for Senator Pappas, your comments about Duluth kind of being inverse of where it used to be. I know in the past there's been several articles a little critical of the Duluth and the maybe sounding the alarm or making corrective actions later than they should have. But you made the comment about it's time, it's good for them to merge. And explain that for those of us that don't sit on the Pension Commission, who they're merging with, and then what's the consequence to the fund? If they're winning, who's losing because of their merger?
Chair Pappas.
The Duluth Fund has been very well run. It's 100 years old, and it's had great returns. And it just a few short years ago, it was fully funded. Like, what year was it fully funded? 2007. Do you want to come up, Jay? Mr. Stoifel did a very good job at running the fund. In 2007, it was 100% funded. So he can talk a little bit more about kind of what happened and, you know, why we feel it's important to merge.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jay Stoffel. I served as the executive director of the Duluth Plan for 22 years. Today I am employed by the TRA, the State Teachers Retirement Association, so I can speak on behalf of the DTRFA to the extent that it helps the committees, but please understand I'm not employed there any longer. The history of the fund, as Senator Pappas explains, has been very good and very healthy, strong returns, very strong actuarially. The crash of 2008 did a real serious number on the fund, as it did all investors. But when you compound that with the demographic issue that was explained previously, that just makes it a very difficult situation to reverse when there's only 800 people contributing members and 1,500 members taking money out of the plan. It's really hard to refill that hole back up again. Even with strong investment returns, it's just upside-down demographics, and that makes it very difficult.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, or to the witness, So if you merge and that benefits Duluth, or they merge, if they benefit, who doesn't benefit, or who's at whose cost?
The cost is to the state. The general fund is that's where the money is coming from.
And that's primarily the $21 million.
That's the $14 million for
14
Duluth,
of the 20.
Right? And I mentioned in my comments that we have done this for other funds. We've helped the police and fire. We've helped Minneapolis teachers and Minneapolis public employees. We have helped St. Paul a little bit in the past and Duluth a little bit in the past, and we have helped TR, Teacher Retirement Association, as well. So this is not, it's not always easy to predict exactly how much the contribution should be, both from the employer and the employee, and how much the rate of return is going to be. I mean, it's an art. It's not a science. And although we do try to be very conservative, you know, there were some years where the stock market was doing very well where we were probably overly generous. And we've kind of learned from our mistakes, and we have a lot of controls now on our ability. That's mostly with COLAs, with the cost of living adjustment. And we do, if the fund falls below a certain point, then the contribution rates go up and the COLAs come down, you know, and they get frozen. But, you know, there's a lot of philosophical difference over COLAs. The purpose of COLA is to maintain the integrity of the retiree's retirement so that it doesn't erode over time. And right now the COLAs we have are not keeping up with inflation.
All right, further questions from the committee? Senator Pappas?
Then, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1803, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Okay. We have the House file that's come over, so I think you'd want to move the House file with the Senate language.
We do. I didn't know that. The House file with the Senate language. Okay, what's the House file number?
1951 is the House file.
1951?
Yes.
Okay, then I move, and that's got the Senate language, though. That House file 1951 is amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor.
So you're right. So first, Senator Pappas, if you'd move the language of the Senate file and place it on to House File 1951.
So moved.
So on that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
And then Senator Pappas moves that House File 1951 as amended be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Pappas.
Okay, thank you very much.
I think I saw Senator Jensen somewhere.
She's in the back.
There's Senator Jensen. Senator Jensen, Senate File 1772.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 1772, basically what it does is it adds three felonies and strikes three felonies from the definition of crimes of violence under the Minnesota Statute 624.712. The felonies that are added is felony assault in the fifth degree, felony domestic assault, and felony assault by strangulation. And the three that are deleted is car theft, looting, and third-degree burglary. This was heard in judiciary and passed, and when the fiscal note came out, there was no fiscal cost within the Department of Corrections, but the Department of Public Safety indicated $16,000 cost to reprogram, do some programming for this change, and they have now indicated that they would be willing to absorb those costs. If there's, I have with me Dana Goetz that would like to talk to that.
Okay. Ms. Goetz.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Dana Goetz. I'm with the BCA. We had originally submitted the fiscal note for $16,000 for, as Senator Jensen said, for the programming and development costs for the criminal history system. It's a really outdated system that's really difficult to make changes to. We received legislative funding last session to replace it, so we're in the process of doing that. But with the bill passing, we would have to make the changes to the current system. But we've agreed that we can do that with an internal resource and just reprioritize his activities so that we could absorb those costs of the $16,000.
Okay, thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Senator Jensen, could you give us some insight into kind of the purpose of the bill? Is it just to reduce, the number of people going to prison, or what's the purpose of the bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, the main objective of the bill is to make sure that the felony level domestic assault offenses that have been left off, the crimes of violence, are on, so people that have a consistent pattern of violent behavior within a relatively short period of time are also included under that crimes of violence framework, which matches what our policies and goals are for what crimes of violence is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jensen, I guess my question related more towards the other issues, the burglary and what was the other?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Goodwin.
Well, that I can explain that because the Judiciary Committee, we decided to take crimes of violence, to make crimes of violence more crimes of violence. So the three that we're taking out of the explanation of crimes of violence are not person-to-person crimes. They're stealing a car or whatever. So it's clean. There's a cleaner description with these three that we took out. It also means that those folks can, that the people that do domestic assault can't get their firearms, but the people who do these other crimes can still get firearms because they're not using firearms in the crime or
whatever. So does that answer your question? Judiciary, we took those three out because they didn't really belong under the explanation of crimes of violence. Stealing a car, theft of property, or third-degree burglary. They're not person-to-person crimes.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions for Senator Jensen or Ms. Goetz? Would anybody like to move the bill?
So moved.
All right, Senator Latz moves that Senate File 1772 be recommended to pass. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Jensen. Okay, members, we have one bill. I'm going to ask Senator Tomasoni to chair. But just want to announce to everybody here, I know normally there's always a big crowd for a bill of mine. And people are very excited usually. But I know a number of you are here for the conference committee, the folks sitting here. And because this room has not been taken down, most of you will be kicked out of the chairs when we're done with the committee meeting, just so you understand that. Because to my left will be Senate staff chairs, to my right, House staff chairs. And so just if folks came here to reserve chairs, you're not going to have them. So just you're welcome to sit around for my bill, but I just want to make sure that the chairs won't be available other than chairs behind the witness table.
Yes. A disaster.
Must be.
Like budget?
Oh.
I'm gone. All you have to do is push the other button when your bill was up.
Your copier
qualified you. Did they really? I'm sorry. I'll talk to the sergeant and see if we
can rewire that desk.
Well, the other day on my corporations,
was on this bill, so
everybody on my side, public corporations, business corporations.
The co-op has come up and explained the bill for me. So we're not going to amend the House file first.
No, it's called this.
Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, this bill is the disaster assistance bill. It's the bill that deals with the special session issue that came up last year relative to unencumbered monies that have been carried over from the Northeastern disaster, which could have been utilized in the absence of a special session, but we didn't have the statutory ability to do that. So that's the thrust of the bill. This is a committee of original jurisdiction. So I do have the A3 author's amendment. Has that been distributed or it's being distributed?
Yes. Does everybody have the A3? We're distributing the A3.
That's okay.
Senator Cohen moves the A3 amendment. Senator Cohen. Explain it, or you just want to put it on?
Mr. Chairman,
it's just
putting an author's amendment.
It's putting it. It's putting it in the form you want it in. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Okay, Mr. Chairman, members. What the bill does, and I'll ask for testimony from both Director Ide and Mr. Freed. But the heart of the bill is contained on page 2. Which sets up the disaster assistance contingency account, and it allows for the placement of monies into this disaster account. So we have an ongoing disaster fund available. The amount of money, and this was contained in the author's amendment, the amount of money carried in the Senate bill is $3 million to be placed into the account. Separate from the building up of the account, under what had been discussed originally, and again with the Senate budget, we don't have that ability right now, was to possibly do this as a statutory appropriation. This is not done as a statutory appropriation, the Senate bill, It's done through the establishment of the special revenue fund to allow for the buildup of the monies. The language in the bill will allow for, again, the automatic transference of monies that are there. So, for instance, what happened last year, members will recall, when we had the disaster in the southwestern part of the state, there was a lot of discussion that we had money carried over from the northeastern disaster the year before. And there was some consideration, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Director Ide can discuss this in more detail. There was discussion in the governor's office about whether or not there was actually the need for a special session because the money was available. Our money was present, but the money was not available absent a statutory authorization. That was the sole purpose for the special session for the southwestern disaster of last year. And the discussion at that time was, why don't we have the statutory authority to simply allow the transference of the money, to have the commissioner of management and budget be able to expend those funds. So the language in the bill establishes that ability to do so, so that the commissioner of management and budget, upon the recommendation of the commissioner of public safety, will have the money available to expend. Now, obviously, if we find ourselves in a situation where a disaster is more expensive than what money is available in the fund, there's still no prohibition, obviously, on having a special session to then deal with what's needed. And Commissioner, or Director Ide can certainly provide testimony as to what the history has been as to how many times maybe you need a special session or not need a special session. The other significant part of the bill is another issue that was raised was whether or not there would be the ability to provide state support for entities that didn't qualify for the federal disaster relief. Gets into some of the federal formulas as to how there's the qualification. This was a particular issue with Ramsey County, I think possibly some other localities, if I'm not mistaken. But because it didn't qualify under the FEMA regulations, there wasn't the ability to include that as part of some of the disaster relief. This allows the establishment of a separate fund called the State Public Assistance Program to provide the appropriate support. One of the things that that we need to be careful about, obviously, is we don't want things to be duplicative. So you'll find language in this that I think that's particularly important to make sure that there's a section that defines eligible costs so that if there are other monies that come in, through volunteer assistance, insurance proceeds, for instance, that you have to take that into account before you actually provide state money. So we're not providing a duplication of support. That's an introduction of the legislation. I'd like to have, again, this is a committee of first jurisdiction, so normally with legislation we don't have testimony unless requested, but because this is the first time this bill has been heard, I've asked that we have some testimony to offer some further explanation and would ask the director to provide some testimony as to where things have been and what this will allow us to do.
Welcome, Ms. Ide. Say your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Ide. I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And as Senator Cohen said, this bill really does two things. It allows the state to set the parameters for dealing with the non-federal match of any presidentially declared disaster. When we have a presidential declaration of major disaster, FEMA provides 75% of the public infrastructure damage, and the state and localities are responsible for the other 25% non-federal share. Because there is so many damages in a community that is not eligible under the FEMA Public Assistance Program, it's been felt that they already have part of that responsibility, financial responsibility for helping themselves recover. This bill then would set that threshold at 25% that the state would provide for the 75% public assistance that FEMA provides. As Senator Cohen also said, this would provide the disaster contingency fund and establish a state public assistance program for those disasters that happen that don't meet the threshold, either as part of a larger presidential declaration or as a threshold that doesn't meet the statewide damage threshold of 7.2 million, but is still devastating to our communities. The legislature in the past has been doing that in the regular sessions when a member will come for their jurisdictions in order to ask for assistance like that. So we have been doing it, but not in a comprehensive, coordinated, and effective manner. Over the since the year 2000, we have actually spent more than $112 million to meet that FEMA 25% non-federal share. And there's been approximately, during that same time, $10 million that have been appropriated for those disasters separately that don't meet that the threshold of a presidential declaration. So you really have been establishing and funding individual disasters that don't meet that that threshold without a public assistance program. This bill has been a joint effort among members, local emergency management organizations, other responder organizations, other state agencies, to be able to also address the 2012 study that the Office of the Legislative Auditor conducted, which asked for two recommendations for that, and one or made two recommendations. One was that the legislature would set clear criteria for determining the level of state funding in three situations: when no federal aid to local jurisdictions were available, when federal aid must be matched by state and local funding, and when jurisdictions receive state flood hazard mitigation grants. This does not address the match for a state for the hazard mitigation grants. It established it for the public public assistance program. Also that it was recommended that the legislature should determine under what circumstances state recovery efforts would be funded for those disasters that do not meet the FEMA criteria. That's what this bill is really meant to do, is to address the concerns by local government and to address the concerns that you all had through the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I believe that that's basically a summary of this bill. It sets out their criteria. We use the same criteria that FEMA uses, so that we are consistent for those counties that have damage that don't meet the FEMA threshold and those counties that do. The same areas in which we fund.
Thank you. Any questions on this item? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cohen, our testifier, how did this group of legislators and other disaster directors come to the conclusion that $3 million was the right number? Was there some type of a look back into past disasters or things that, or what was the criteria for setting that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, the answer is somewhat simple. I'll look back to the questions asked on Senator Pappas' bill. We had a fairly tight budget target for the supplemental finance bill, and $3 million was the amount available. But let me make it very clear. That's the money used to provide first funding into this disaster account. Number one, it doesn't prevent future legislatures from providing any kind of augmentation of that amount. So if we, you know, next year when we have the regular budget, the 16-17 budget, hypothetically, if the governor wishes to provide more money into that account, that would be a recommendation that made it to the legislature. The Senate, in the Senate budget, could do the same. So there's nothing magic about the $3 million figure. The other thing I want to emphasize, as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, is that if a particular disaster is of huge expense and there's not enough money in the account, you're not going to put a stop then and say we've reached our statutory limit. There's nothing of that sort intended. This is basically to set up not so much the amount of money, but a framework for, first of all, allowing for the transference as might have taken place last year, and second, to make sure that there's the ability to deal with entities that are not eligible for the federal share. So I don't want any misunderstanding that the $3 million represents the total commitment on the part of the Senate relative to any disasters. There have been various figures floating around, and to be honest, you know, I'm kind of breaking the rule about making a reference to the other body, but you know, they had more monies available. We kept more money at the bottom line.
Okay. Senator Anderson. Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Cohen, or to your testifier, I'm guessing that during the you're coming together to discuss the parts of the bill and thing, that there was a look back on the average of disasters and the cost to the state of Minnesota. Was there any type of a figure that came to the top of the surface that can be given to us?
100 million? What was the number? No, just kidding. Ms. Idy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, over the last 20 years, we have spent approximately $5.8 million every year for the non-federal share of FEMA declared disasters.
Halfway there. Okay. Mr. Fried. Senator Lacks.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry if you already mentioned this, but how do you define disaster in this bill?
Ms. Idy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lacks, we disaster is actually defined in the CFR, which is a disaster that, that is greater than the ability of the local unit of government and the state government to recover on their own, then it becomes a major disaster as declared by the president. In the eyes of the federal formula, it is about $1.21 per capita for the state threshold of public infrastructure damage, which is, in Minnesota's case, $7.2 million per disaster is considered a disaster. And then on the county level, the state has to meet the $7.2 million threshold, and each county that's eligible has to meet a $3.50 per capita.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Latz, there's a further definition when we have a little bit more discussion from Mr. Fried relative to the public assistance, the state public assistance program. There's a state definition contained within this bill, separate from the federal definition.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Latz.
These are natural disasters, then, not man-made disasters or disasters of
Mr. Chair,
man-made
Senator Latz, it could be technological disasters also, natural and technological disasters, such as chemical spill.
What about, for example, a bridge collapse?
That would be considered a technological disaster, and I believe that is covered under here.
Was I-35 bridge, was that?
That ended up being a federal declaration of an emergency. Okay. So that has doesn't have a threshold. It has kind of a cap on it. So that was treated a little bit differently.
Okay. Well,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Lacks.
We didn't have a fund set up to be used to compensate victims in the bridge collapse. And I don't believe we had a fund set up to reconstruct the bridge, although I don't recall I wasn't involved in that part of it. Would this bill include disaster relief funding to compensate victims of any of the disasters, I guess natural or man-made, or would that still remain a separate legislative process if we wish to do that?
Mr. Chairman, that's not contemplated, and the director can testify. I don't think the compensation of victims is included in the federal definition anywhere.
No. Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, this is a public assistance, state public assistance program. There is the individual assistance program, which we are not addressing at this time. So it does not compensate disaster survivors.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Fried. Just say your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Judson Freed. I'm Director of Emergency Management and Homeland Security for Ramsey County. I also serve as the Chair of the Government Affairs Committee of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, and it's in that capacity that I appear before you this afternoon. That association, AMEM, as you may or may not know, represents 450-plus emergency management professionals from all 87 counties, all the cities of the first class, and most of the other municipal jurisdictions in our state. I've been a professional emergency manager for a little more than 25 years, and for the last eight, I've been working to try and get something like this before you. So, Senator Cohen, I deeply appreciate your efforts here today, and I appreciate your efforts, Senators, in at least listening to us and hopefully in passing this forward. A number of questions that came up, and hopefully I'll address them a little bit, but, you know, the federal government has been providing emergency assistance to local governments in the event of a disaster since 1803, and it's certainly not the role of the federal government or the state government to bail us at the local level out every time something goes wrong, and we don't believe that, and we don't ask you to do that. But with the growth in population and the increase in development of properties, the fiscal impact and the personal impact to people as a result of natural and technological disasters has done nothing but increase. And there comes a point where local communities can no longer cope, and we need help. And that's what brings us here today. One of the things that was often asked of me in developing some of this is, you know, well, you know, you guys should have skin in the game at the local level, and we do. As Director Ide alluded to, we absorb a lot of the fiscal costs, the training and the planning and the reconstruction costs, but we also have real skin in the game, the flesh and blood of my first responders and our people who are backing them up as second response and trying to put these things together. Those folks are out there every day, and they respond to every emergency, whether or not there's any promise of reimbursement or not. So our skin is really real. Plus, once the cameras leave, the reconstruction and the continuing dealing with these disasters remains at the local level. We continue to do this sometimes for decades after the event happens. And quite honestly, those first few months afterwards, when we can figure out what our financial capability to rebuild our communities may or may not be, are critical to how the entire emergency is resolved, even decades down the line. So, as the director alluded to, the existing federal law, which is the basis for this law, establishes what is a disaster. And by doing that, we're using national best practices, the same best practices that are on every other state, including those states that already have laws like this on the books, so that we're not asking for something that doesn't currently exist. A disaster has to have a very large process behind it. First of all, you're asking local government officials to tell their constituents that despite their planning and despite the money they've already spent on training law enforcement and fire and EMS and other, we can't cope with this situation. And for an local elected official, that's a big deal. And when we ask for help, it's because we have no other option. We don't do it lightly. Secondly, that in addition to that, we have to take the normal mitigation and risk management courses of any governmental agency. We have to have our insurance. We have to have things in place. And this law mandates that as well. We're not allowed to skimp on that or somehow slide and let the state cover something for us, because the law says that if it's determined that this should have been insured, it's not covered. As the director said, there's a per capita indicator of $3.50 per capita in the county, and that $7 million statewide. So if either one of those isn't reached, that affected county is not considered part of the disaster area. Last year during the floods, Ramsey County absorbed a little over $1 million in damages. After you figured all the insurance and all the things that were supposed to be in place, there was still about $1 million in damage. And when 18 counties were declared as federal disaster areas, that wasn't our limit. Our limit's $1.6 million, so we were not declared. My communities, no community any longer has those rainy day funds to be able to cope with that. So we make hard choices. We don't hire those police officers. We don't fix those potholes because we had to rebuild just to keep the basic functions of life going on. This bill will help us address that in a rapid fashion. In the case of my county, I can lose the entire city of Falcon Heights. I can have it eliminated from the face of the earth by a tornado, so there's nothing left but dirt, and I will not hit the per capita threshold for a presidential disaster. But I'll have to tell that to the citizens of Falcon Heights, that, hey, there's no aid coming. So instead, what ends up happening is we come before you every year, local government comes before you and says, hey, please help. And quite honestly, you guys do it. You do come through. But it takes months and months of action and usually a very expensive special session. And this law would resolve that. It would help us to meet some of our need, including still having some additional fiscal responsibility. 25% of that would still be ours, at a slightly lower threshold based on that federal threshold, which, by the way, adjusts in October so that it is kept up to date, and wouldn't require any new unfunded training mandates or process mandates because we're following the same set of rules that are already existent in the federal Code of Federal Regulations. The thing that would happen is that aid would come to us faster. I'd be able to start making our plans for how we can recover our community. Because remember, we're going to go out there and start saving lives. We're going to bring my first responders in. Minneapolis will send mutual aid. When they had their tornado, I spent 2 weeks in their emergency operations center because our county sent aid to the city of Minneapolis. This is kind of a remarkable bill when you think about it. You have local government. You have all 87 counties in the form of the Association of Minnesota Counties supporting it, all of the townships and state agencies all agreeing that this is a good idea. That, I don't know how often that happens as a spectator, not often. Not only that, you have the city of St. Paul and Ramsey County agreeing on something. It's a pretty amazing thing when you think about it. So what we're asking, ladies and gentlemen, is very simple. We're asking that you take the proactive step to fund this account. Fund this account as your partners across the hall have already done by a vote of 124 to nothing. And we also, our association asks, on behalf of all of the 87 counties, every township, every fire department in this state, that you consider fully funding it at the same amount that the state did. We did our research, and that number is about $5.8 million. We asked for $5.661 million, and that's what went through on the other side. And while we will be happy if you pass with $3 million, we would be ecstatic if you would take a look at the real disasters out there and help us to help the citizens of Minnesota recover from these things happening. Because I can tell you, I don't know if there'll be another bridge collapse. I don't know if a building will fall down. I don't know if Al-Qaeda will attack. But I spend a lot of time and your money and my effort planning to try and deal with it. But I do know that we will have a flood. I do know we will have a tornado. I do know that we will have severe winds that will cause damages to the people who live in this state, and we can help them. We will help them. We're asking you to help us. So on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers, once again, Senator Cohen, thank you so much for allowing me to be here today. And senators, thank you for your time. I'm ready to answer any questions if you have, or back off.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, you had me until you told me the 124 to nothing on the other side.
Sorry about that.
No, I'm just kidding.
For the record, no.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, we have Representative Plowski in here, Senator, and I know he spent a lot of time and put a lot of effort in this, too, so I think we should just, or I'd like to thank him for his hard work on this legislation as well.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, I appreciate that, and I didn't realize Representative Pulaski had come in. And to be fair, I know I'm not supposed to say something like this with all the other, but he's been the driving force with this and obviously has had direct experience with what happened in your part of the state. So it's been an effort that has been both educational and I think up to this point very productive.
So with all the extensive references to the other body here today, nobody said the H word, so that's good. Okay, so Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think we should vote now because I think everybody has a pretty good idea of what's going on here. And we understand, and of course, we've got the chair's bill here, and pretty likely that we're all going to vote for it.
Yeah, well, and Mr. Fried said it was remarkable, so I just want that noted for the record.
If you hadn't made that suggestion, Senator Goodwin, we probably would have voted by now. Senator Cohen, any final comments?
No, I think the discussion from both Director Ide and Mr. Fried has been such that they've offered a very excellent perspective on what we're attempting to do. I just want to get back for just a second to Senator Anderson's question relative to the dollars. In a supplemental finance year, you don't have quite the maneuvering room. I'm hoping maybe during the conference committee process we'll be able to bring it back up possibly to, as the director has pointed out, what has been the average cost. That's what was in the original bill. But certainly it provides the framework to make sure that we do have this taken care of, hopefully, over these subsequent years. So I'd be happy to move, first of all, the placement of the language on Senate File 2601 into House File 2701. Would make that motion.
As amended. As amended.
As amended, yes.
Okay, so Senator Cohen moves the contents of Senate File 2601 as amended to replace the contents of House File 2701. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion adopted. No.
And then, Mr. Chairman, I move that House File 2701 as amended be recommended to pass.
On that motion, Senator Anderson.
Thank you. I just have one question. It talks in the audit on page 9 of the bill that talks about payment, and then it talks about final payment. I'm just wondering if in making these payments for these disasters, are they paid out in like one-fourth, one-half, three-quarters, and then there's a final payment? Or how are the payments made for the disaster to the whatever part of the state is made? Maybe Ms. Heidi.
Ms. Heidi. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, it a lot depends on what how large the project is. If we have a large project, which is over $70,000, we pay it out on a reimbursement, and then we hold back 10% until the audit is done. And then we will pay that remaining